Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How confident are you in your ability to plan for your financial future? Most of us understand that we need to start saving years before the age at which we hope to retire. But in the meantime, there are also more immediate demands on our income, from basic expenses like food, housing, and transportation, to paying off credit card debts and student loans, or putting money away to help children go to college. So what does it take to balance the books and achieve our goals? We've asked two experts to join us today and address your questions. Crystal Billing is a certified financial planner with CFO for Life. Thomas E. Murphy is a certified financial planner with Murphy and Silvest. Both are on the board of directors of the Financial Planning Association of Dallas-Fort Worth. They're here with us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Tom, Crystal, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
So let's start with something that many people resolve to do at the start of every year, which is get a handle on their debt. How do you suggest people prioritize paying off what they owe?
Well, the first thing to do is find out what they owe. And many people are shocked and amazed when they actually sit down and make a list of all their credit cards, car loans, mortgages, everything. So the first step is writing it down. The second step is looking to see what interest rate is being paid. An important thing to remember about debt is not all interest is tax deductible. So sometimes the taxes can drive the decision. It would make more sense to pay off high interest rate debt that is not tax deductible before paying a lower interest rate debt or a lower rate that is deductible, such as a mortgage.
So in other words, rather than, say, for now, socking extra money into a mortgage, you might want to first pay off all those credit cards.
For example, and we actually had that happen with a client who was paying 29% interest on a credit card and 4.3% interest on a mortgage and was making extra payments on the mortgage because he didn't realize that he was paying interest on credit cards. And fortunately, the credit card companies have now reformatted their statements. So it's much easier now to see if you are paying interest.
How should we make decisions about putting money into savings if we still have ongoing debt?
The easiest way to do that is to look at whether you currently have an emergency fund versus what types of savings you're looking at. It doesn't make a lot of sense to pay down a credit card debt if you have no money and there's a high probability that you're just going to have to run that credit card debt right back up again. By the same token, it's very, very difficult for people to reduce their current standard of living. So my suggestion would be, since it is January and since many people get a raise or a promotion or a bonus at the first of the year, commit to taking whatever that additional amount of money is and allocate half of it towards paying down that debt and half of it towards building up an emergency fund equal to at least 1 month's living expenses, or even $1,000, or just pick a number that is a meaningful number that once you achieve it, you'll feel more confident that you can then allocate more of the money towards paying down the debt.
So the American dream historically includes owning one's own home. Does this make financial sense for everybody, or are there cases where renting might be a better idea?
Well, and again, this is a case-by-case situation. A lot of people do feel that owning a home has its own benefits, but it also has a lot of expenses that come along with it. So that's a big thing for somebody to consider in looking at whether they should own or rent. Obviously, everybody looks at this and say, you know, the asset is their home. They want to build that asset. They don't like paying rent because they don't like just throwing money down the tube. So they really have to consider what they can handle financially and whether they should. Leasing or buying will help them determine if they have, you know, the emergency reserve set aside. There's things that to consider before going into that avenue.
There are two rules of thumb that are very helpful when trying to decide between renting and buying. One is, if you're not going to live in the house for a minimum of 3 years, don't buy. Rent, because it simply costs too much money in closing costs and everything else to buy and then get relocated to a different part of the country and move and buy again. The second rule to remember, and this is somewhat unique to Texas and in particular North Texas, is besides the principal and interest that you're paying on the mortgage, you should expect to pay about 7% of the fair market value of that house per year in insurance, taxes, utilities, repairs, maintenance, and upkeep. Now, if it's a brand new house, the number will be a little bit less, but an older house, it might even be more. If you don't have the cash flow to be able to pay that 7%, then you can end up in a situation where even though you buy a house, you're not able to maintain it, and you're certainly not able to enjoy any other financial successes because you won't have any additional dollars.
In the mortgage crisis, a lot of people discovered that what they could afford for a home and what banks at the time were willing to lend them for a home were two different things. Is there a sort of a simple formula to help us determine how much realistically and responsibly we can pay for a home as you know, compared to our salaries?
Well, and I'll defer to Tom. He's good with the number part of it in terms of how much you should be spending in relation to your income. But you are absolutely correct. There were the days where they would lend anybody anything up to 90% to 100%, depending on how you formatted the loan. And I think that got a lot of people into trouble. And lenders have really tightened their belt on that. And you'll see that it is very difficult for people to get mortgages these days.
I like to have my clients be able to pay 20% down and be able to afford to make the monthly mortgage payments on a 15-year mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that that's what they necessarily should do, but if they can do both of those things, then I'm pretty confident that they're not buying too much house. If they can't do those things, then I would suggest that they either consider postponing and building up a larger house down payment fund, or that they consider a smaller house. And the reason is when you buy a house, it's not just the house. It's moving in, it's furnishing, it's doing everything else. So if you could put 20% down with a 15-year mortgage, and then you actually put 10% down on a 30-year mortgage, you're going to have plenty of free cash flow.
So what are the different strategies for when we're saving for, say, a down payment on a house or something we want to do within the next 3 to 5 years as compared with saving for, say, a two-year-old's college education or saving for retirement in terms of how we should manage that money?
The easiest way to do it is, as we mentioned before, allocate all raises, promotions, any additional dollars. The easiest thing in the world to do is to commit today to not spend money that you haven't received yet.
That makes it sound very simple, actually.
A lot of people don't think of it that way. But if you get a rebate from the IRS and you weren't expecting it, then put that money aside. Commit that that's what you're going to do. Now, obviously, it's easier to do that if you have a goal like buying a house. The other thing to do is it depends on how old you are and what kind of profession you're in. If you're younger, if you're in your 20s or 30s, you probably are having pretty significant increases in your income on a fairly regular basis because that's the normal pattern. As you gain skills, as you gain experience, your income goes up pretty dramatically. And in fact, by the time you're 35 to 45 are the transition years where many people's income goes up almost exponentially. And if you plan in advance to allocate those dollars towards specific goals, then you will be so far ahead of your peers who simply increase their discretionary spending on whatever toy of the day strikes their fancy. You'll be so far ahead. And this applies both to savings and investing. The one thing I do want to mention about a down payment on a house is that money should not be put in the stock market. These are dollars that you're going to need for a relatively short-term goal. Therefore, they should be in cash, cash equivalent, or very conservative investments.
Things like CDs?
CDs, short-term bonds, things that you could turn into cash relatively easily because you need them at a particular point in time.
All right, let's talk a little bit about retirement and calculating how much we need. There are a variety of different formulas out there. I think Fidelity's pushing this, you know, 8 times to 10 times your annual savings. Some people will say 15 times or annual income. Some people will say you have to get to 15 times your annual income. Many people look at these numbers and think, there's just no way that I can put this much away. How can we know how much we will realistically need?
Well, and I think that varies by the professional that you talk to or the avenue that you know, the different websites that you see or Fidelity. But everybody kind of has their own explanation. I like to look at it from an expense perspective. How much are you spending now? How much money do you need? That will help equate to how much money you need in the future. Mm-hmm. If you're spending, you know, net $100,000 a year and that's what it costs and you have two kids, more than likely once you retire, some of that spending isn't going to be needed because a lot of those expenses will go down maybe by about 20%. So you want to, I like to look at it from a cash outflow perspective. What is that amount of money that you need to solve for to get you that, you know, $80,000 a year to spend in future dollars? And I know Tom probably has a really good perspective on this as well.
I thought that was a pretty good perspective. Figuring out where you are spending your money is very important. And as Crystal mentioned, child-related expenses can be quite a bit higher than you might think. As I also just mentioned, housing-related expenses can be quite high, that 7% of the fair market value of the home. We've worked with some clients who were spending 40% of their gross earnings on child and housing-related expenses when their plan was, obviously, the children will then leave the home and go elsewhere. So,
God willing, right?
Well, and not come back. But in retirement, or what we prefer to call financial independence, mm-hmm. Financial independence is you're working because you want to and not because you have to. Whether or not you choose to retire is a completely separate issue. But the question is, how much are you currently spending on child-related things and how much are you spending on housing? And then if the decision is, all right, when I retire, I'm not going to need that 5-bedroom, 3-bath home and live in 3 rooms.
Mm-hmm.
I could downsize into something that is smaller, more economical, easier to maintain, and, oh, by the way, allows me to take trips to the places that I've always wanted to see.
I want to talk about financial hiccups because this series that we've done has really focused on people who, you know, suffer a crisis and are in really dire straits. I've looked at some online calculators and they ask you to plug in your income and how much you're saving now, but they never say, there's no sort of button for you to fill in, what if I'm unemployed for 18 months and really have to cope with that? And how should we all, given the way the economy works today, make contingencies for this very real possibility, even for people who are, you know, expecting to work the entire time?
That's a very, very good question that many people do not address, and they should. If you look at IRS statistical data, what you will find is there's almost a 100% chance that sometime between when people start working and when they retire, they will be below the poverty level for at least 1 year.
Hmm.
Now, what that means in many cases is they had a period of involuntary unemployment, sometimes known as being fired, sometimes known as your company went bankrupt, whatever, but a period of involuntary unemployment, and their income drops to very, very little. And these are not the people you think of when you start thinking in terms of the poverty level. If there's almost 100% chance of that happening, either due to unemployment or health issues or whatever, then it can happen to almost everyone, and everyone needs to be planning to put aside that emergency fund we spoke about before. So bringing it up to perhaps a 12-month emergency fund would be wonderful.
My guests are Thomas E. Murphy and Crystal Billing, both certified financial planners and both members of the board of directors of the Financial Planning Association of Dallas-Fort Worth. We're talking as part of our One Crisis Away initiative about planning for your financial future. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
If something was to happen with his job, we would have a very difficult time, and vice versa. I think that would put our family in a very, very difficult position, and we would have to change our lifestyle a lot. I mean, we're frugal. So just with us being frugal and having to, you know, even dial back, you know, what we would spend, it would be a crisis.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about financial planning as part of KERA's One Crisis Away series. What you just heard was a bit from a story that tomorrow during Morning Edition will run. Courtney Collins has the story of Schneek and J.C. Dory of White Settlement. She's a middle school English teacher. He's a truck driver. They're doing okay financially, but Schneek, as you heard, is not sure what would happen in a crisis, a situation that many North Texans find themselves in over the years. My guests this hour are both on the board of directors of the Financial Planning Association of Dallas-Fort Worth, which you can find online at fpanet.org. Thomas E. Murphy is a certified financial planner with Murphy and Silvest, and Crystal Billing is a certified financial planner with CFO for Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, I want to get to phone calls in a very short time, but one more question about retirement savings. Everybody's been told you should start very early. Sometimes, for a variety of reasons, people don't. And then everybody starts to panic, and then they figure it's not even worth it to try now because they can't build up a critical mass. Do you have any suggestions for people who feel like maybe they're getting in the game too late, but recognize that it's time to make some positive changes?
Well, and that's a very good question, and everybody goes through that thought process of whether I start too late or not. I think you can never start too early, and you can never start too late. Having something in place is better than nothing. Mm-hmm. So I think Tom is going to be really good at finishing the answer to that question as well.
It's very common for people in their 50s to get a little love note from that organization that makes you then think that, oh, my word, I'm getting close to retirement. It is possible to start in your 50s accumulating money and have a successful financial retirement. What it involves is a lot of discipline. Mm-hmm. In particular, figuring out how much money you were spending on child-related expenses and then allocate those dollars towards your retirement without falling into the trap many people do when their children leave of then going out and buying their dream home or buying some toy that they've always wanted but they felt that they couldn't afford. In general, your housing-related expenses go down at a predictable rate depending upon how many people are in the house. Part of this is food. Part of it is electricity usage and whatnot. And the formula itself is fairly complex, but it is not unusual for your discretionary expenses to go down about 40%. Once the children leave. Obviously, this is assuming you're no longer paying for college or mm-hmm. any of that. Those dollars in and of themselves can be enough for you to have a successful retirement. Now, obviously, if you start in your 20s saving 10% of your gross income, you're going to be fine. If you wait until your mid-30s, you need to save about 20%. And if you wait until your 50s, you need to save about 40%. Those are the rough numbers. But that's assuming you're going to maintain the same standard of living in retirement as what you have today. As we discussed earlier, many people choose to downsize or right-size, and that dramatically decreases their living expenses. So it's possible to save even relatively modest amounts of money, and between Social Security and other sources of revenue, have plenty.
What are the options for people whose companies don't provide, say, a 401k or another kind of tax-deferred retirement savings program? What do you recommend?
Well, if you don't have something like that available to you through your employer, it's strongly recommended to start an individual retirement account.
IRA.
An IRA. So in most cases, depending on your income, the limit for IRA contribution is up to $5,500. Definitely not the 17.5 that you're allowed in a 401k through an employer. But again, that allows you to put some tax-deferred money away. And in most cases, if you do not have an employer-sponsored plan available to you, those contributions will be tax-deductible. So you have both of those benefits. And if you don't have the 401k through your employer, it's strongly recommended to get started somewhere. And definitely the IRA would be the primary place to do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Gabriel in Plano. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I'm planning to send her to the college. I'm already late to start saving for her tuition. I would like to know, I have making some research, and I have found out that the 529 that guarantees to freeze the tuition for the state of Texas is no longer available. I would like to know what is the best way. I can save like $100 a week for her tuition. So I would like to know what's the best place where I can put this money and make it grow, because the tuition grows like a 2 times the inflation rate.
Right. Gabriel, so, how old is your daughter now, just so we know?
She's 10.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call.
First of all, congratulations, Gabriel, on making the decision to do something for the college education for your daughter. The most meaningful way to provide for financial success for your children is to help them get as much education as possible of the best quality. We'll answer your question, but I want to point something out to you first, and that is your daughter may very well qualify for all kinds of financial aid from different colleges. And it might be – I'm not saying that you shouldn't put money aside for her. That's a great idea. But don't discount the fact that some of the least expensive schools in the nation in terms of what you would pay out of pocket are the ones that on first blush appear to be the most expensive. So, for example, Harvard – is one of the most expensive schools on paper, but they also have the largest endowment of any college in the nation, and they provide more financial aid to their students than anyone else. In fact, there's kind of a rule of thumb that if your adjusted gross income is less than $180,000, your child can go to almost any of the Ivy League schools tuition-free. And if your adjusted gross income is less than $100,000, which is true of many, if not most, people in Dallas, then your child can go both tuition-free and room and board-free. Now, obviously, this isn't easy. Your child has to make a real effort in school academically, has to be qualified, has to apply, has to get in. But so many children and parents discount even the concept of applying to some of these premier schools because they just assume they can't afford it, and that's not the case. Now, having said all that, $100 a week is a lot. So I would suggest looking into a Section 529 plan. There are many different plans. In Texas, since we don't have a state income tax, you can use any plan from any state. The money that goes in is after tax, but then it grows tax-free. And then when the money comes out to pay for your daughter's college education, that is also tax-free. So it's a great place to put money aside for her college education.
And in families with multiple children, right, if you have a 529 in the name of one child and that child doesn't use the money for whatever reason, it can be transferred to someone else in the family?
Yes, you are correct. You can change the beneficiary within the family. So sometimes I tell my clients that even if the youngest child doesn't use all of their money and you decide to go back to college or do something, then you can utilize those funds as well. So you are absolutely correct. It is transferable.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Bill in Richardson. Hi, Bill.
It's the youngest child.
Bill, can you turn off your radio, please?
Go back to college or do something.
Okay, we're not really hearing from Bill, so we will move on. We have an email here from Greg in Dallas who says, my employer has notified us that beginning this year, we'll have to pay $5.83 per month to the institution that administers our 401k. Is this the latest trend?
That is very common. to have the internal expenses of a 401k plan that is passed on through the employer, from the employer to the employee. And that is, and again, it's not uncommon to see that. Usually it comes, most times it comes in the way of internal expenses within the investments that you have within your 401k, so you don't see that. So in this case, they were probably already paying the fees. Previously, they just didn't see it, and so they may have changed their 401k platform, and so now they're just seeing that come through to the participant versus it built in internally.
We had a discussion on the show a few months ago about the huge variation of in different funds of the amounts of money charged for the administration and management of those funds, and they can make, I guess, a significant impact over time in how much people are able to accumulate. Can you talk about what's a realistic fee as a percentage to pay on particular investments?
It's very difficult to give one answer to a question like that because it depends on what kind of investment. So let's talk about different asset classes. If you're in an international emerging market value fund, okay, what does that mean in English? So these are companies, small companies that are in small, relatively undeveloped parts of the world. You're going to need a manager, and that manager is going to have to go spend time out on the ground, and that is going to be expensive. Someone has to pay it. Now, let's contrast that with if you want to buy a fund that mirrors the S&P 500 index in the United States. Well, there are many different funds that do that, and it's relatively easy, and therefore it's not that expensive. So what many people in our profession recommend is that you would have a core investment portfolio of those things where it's relatively inexpensive for the manager to take care of it. And then there would be what's called a satellite approach. And the satellite would be those positions that, for example, are international or emerging market or someplace else. And it's perfectly acceptable for those to be more expensive. Now, the real question beyond the what is the expense is what kind of return are you getting relative to other funds of those type or relative to an index? And I would strongly suggest that everyone take a look at if they're in a fund, take a look at that fund, look at the investment performance, look at the index for that fund, and then compare the two and see if you're getting value for your dollars.
Another financial crisis that nobody sort of imagines early on in their life, but that affects a lot of people over time is things like divorce. What do you recommend to people who are at any age sort of having to rebuild their lives financially after splitting up with a partner?
The first and most important thing to remember is two people cannot live and maintain the same standard of living as they as separate individuals as they could when they were married. I see far too often one or the other trying to maintain the home, maintain the standard of living, maintain all the same things on half the income. It simply cannot be done. So the first and most important thing to do is sit down, look at how much money you have, and put together a realistic budget based on what you actually have given your other goals and objectives. In most, if not, I don't say all cases, but in most cases, that's going to mean selling the home and moving into a place that is more modest.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also contact the show via email to think@kera.org or send a tweet to me at Chris Boyd Think. How important is life insurance and how long do we need it?
There's many different approaches that you can take when determining the type of life insurance and when it's needed. For example, if you have small children, then there's going to be a need for income replacement. That's the primary uses for life insurance is income replacement, maybe paying off debts, or to fund some goal that you have, whether it's funding your child's college, if something were to happen to you, leaving an inheritance for your children. If you know, I want to leave this much to my children, then that's when you would decide the amount. And if it's something, if that's your goal, then that's something that you don't know when that day's going to come. So you're going to look for a type of insurance that is permanent or lasts throughout your life. When it comes to funding education or short-term goals or you know, the income replacement needed while you have children at home. Then you identify if they're small children. So say if you have 5-year-olds at home, and they'll probably be self-sufficient in 15 years, then you would look at a short-term policy, a term, you know, maybe a 15-year term to help subsidize, if something were to happen, the income that you would need to provide for your family.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Lori in McKinney. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Hi. So my question, and excuse me if I use some of the wrong financial terminology for it. I have had colleagues in the past who have had problems where their child has been declared as a dependent on their income taxes for, you know, their entire years of being a minor. And then when the child applied for financial aid to the college, the parents make too much money, and so the child doesn't qualify for financial aid because they're not considered to be in need, mm-hmm. even though the parent may not necessarily have saved enough money. And so we're in a situation where we declare my stepdaughter in our insurance, in our taxes, but we haven't been able, you know, I picked her up later in life because she's my stepdaughter, and so I haven't been able to save enough money to have for her to go to college in 3 or 4 years. Is there a time frame where you should stop declaring that child as a dependent and let them file income taxes independently, say 2 years before they're going to go to college or 1 year before they're going to go to college, so that when they apply for their financial aid, they look to be as financially needy as they are for that situation?
All right, Laura, I appreciate your call and your question. We need to take a quick break now, so we'll get an answer for you after that break. We're speaking this hour with certified financial planners Crystal Billing and Thomas E. Murphy. Both are on the board of directors of the Financial Planning Association of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find them online at fpanet.org. They're here today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. If you want to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933. 5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. As part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative, we're speaking this hour with certified financial planners Thomas E. Murphy of Murphy and Silvest and Crystal Billing of CFO for Life. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Lori was asking about how to deal with a stepchild's status as a dependent minor for purposes of applying for college age, aid. What do you think, Tom?
Lori, it's a good question. And that is an approach that I have heard some people use. But I think you can accomplish the same thing a different way. And that is when you fill out the FAFSA form, which is the federal form for student aid. In a divorce situation, it's one parent or the other. So my question would be, does your stepdaughter's mother have an income level and an asset level that is lower than yours? And if that's the case, I would suggest having her mother fill out the FAFSA form with her assets, and therefore the stepdaughter might qualify that way. Now, having said that, Some colleges go strictly based on what the FAFSA says. Many other colleges will come back in and say, in addition to the FAFSA, I want you to provide us with tax returns from both parents and lots of other information. It just depends upon how those particular schools calculate financial aid. So this is one of those areas where you might want to consult with a specialist in this area to look at your specific situation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mary in Corinth. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I have a question about taxes. My husband and I owe the IRS a lot of money. We both work full-time, but I also am an independent contractor, and I've had some very good years and some bad years, too. And during the good years, I didn't put the money aside to pay the taxes, but because we were doing pretty well, we could pay them off every year. The last couple of years, we've had to get on an installment plan. We owe about upwards of $20,000. And I wanted to know, we have I have a Fidelity rollover plan or IRA plan, and I wanted to know, would it make sense to use some of that money to pay it off or take out a loan? Because it just seems like we're never going to get out of it.
All right, Mary, I appreciate your call, and I want to caution everyone here that, of course, Tom and Crystal can't give specific financial advice, but maybe you guys can talk generally about when it might be appropriate to dip into a deferred tax account.
Mm-hmm. And this is a good question for you, Lori. Mary, I apologize. Probably if you have an installment plan with the IRS, it would behoove you to continue on with that installment plan versus taking money out of your retirement accounts, because the IRS has obviously set up a plan for you to continue paying, if rather than taking money from your own assets to pay off that debt. So I wouldn't advise liquidating any retirement plans, because depending on your age, that will create an additional tax liability as well. And there's very few exclusions that they allow that will not result in a penalty when taking out of your retirement plans. And unfortunately, paying off IRS debt is not one of those.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hi. First of all, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to your guest is, I have a 529 set up for my kids, and wanted to ask a question about does it affect getting him or her financial aid?
Yes, it does. The 529 plans are disclosed on the FAFSA form. However, what you will find is the amount of impact on the child's financial aid is much less than if you had accounts in your child's name. So what do I mean by that? If you had money in the child's name when they're applying for financial aid, approximately 33 cents on the dollar counts against them for qualifying for financial aid. Money that's in your name as the parent, including with the 529, is down around about 5.6 to 5.7 cents on the dollar. Now, interestingly enough, money that's in a grandparent's name, if the grandparents are going to be paying directly to the educational institution, doesn't get included at all on the FAFSA form. So sometimes we'll recommend, when a grandparent wants to help out with a grandchild, we will counsel the grandparent to not put money in the child or grandchild's name, but to keep it at their level and use it to help after all other financial aid opportunities have been exhausted.
We've heard the advice before that, of course, everyone who possibly can wants to help their kids get a good education. But the question is, if it's a choice between saving for retirement and paying into a child's college fund, and it's sort of an agonizing dilemma, I think, for a lot of parents. But can you address that and what people should do if they can do one but not both?
If I were advising someone to do one or the other, I would advise them to put the money into their retirement. And the reason is, your child can do a work-study program, can get financial aid, can get loans, can do things, and then eventually can pay off those loans and go off into society. If you put all the money into your child's college education and you don't have a retirement, when you get to retirement age, nobody's going to give you a loan. So unless you really like your children a whole lot and are planning to go live with them in retirement, I would strongly recommend you put the money aside towards your retirement. And then later on, after the children graduate, there's nothing that says that you can't help them pay off those loans later on if it turns out you have the money to do so.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Louise in Dallas. Hi, Louise.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, I'm a single person and I've been saving into an IRA. I'm self-employed. And I don't know if I should convert my IRA to a Roth IRA.
Well, first, explain for all of us the difference between an IRA and a Roth IRA.
That's a very good question, Chris. Yes, the difference between a Roth IRA is that you're putting money in after tax. So the government, the IRS, has already gotten their taxes on that income that you've earned. You've taken that money and you've put it into a tax-deferred vehicle, in this case, a Roth IRA. So there's no tax deduction for a Roth IRA contribution. Now, with a Roth IRA, you're not required to take money out at 70 and a half or there's no requirements to take distributions over your lifetime. And then whenever you do take money out of the Roth IRA, it is not taxable. Now, on a traditional IRA or an IRA where you get a deduction when you put the money in, that there are several requirements that the government has in regards to taking distributions from that account. Now, when you look at whether to convert an IRA to a Roth IRA, that is, you know, it varies by each individual situation, what their current income level is. And what that allows you to do is take your bucket, it takes your bucket of traditional, your IRA money that's, you know, it's already, it's pre-tax. So once you convert it to a Roth IRA, then those funds are then going to be taxable in that year. So you'll want to take that into consideration in looking at your entire tax situation and your financial situation, whether that's going to help or hurt you in that year. Tom?
The name of the game with retirement planning and taxes is to pay taxes in the lowest possible bracket whenever you can. So if it's a traditional IRA where the money goes in pre-tax and comes out taxed, that's the right answer if you're going to be in a lower tax bracket in the future than you are today. If, on the other hand, you think you're going to be in a higher tax bracket in the future than you are today, then a Roth IRA is the correct approach. So if you don't think in terms of should I do a conversion or not, but think in terms of am I in the lowest tax bracket that I am likely to be in my life? And then look at it from that standpoint. And if the answer is no, I'm not, I'm probably going to be in a lower tax bracket in the future, don't do the conversion.
And I think Crystal mentioned earlier that the limits for a traditional IRA, it's like $5,500 a year. Is there a similar limit for Roth IRAs?
Yes, there is. It is similar limitations for whether it's a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA. And it is $5,500, and then you're allowed another $500 contribution if you're over the age of 50. Now, when you look in terms of a self-employed individual like Louise, there is what they consider a SEP IRA, which is a self-employed pension, and that is an income-based retirement plan, and there are different limitations based on up to – there could be a combined contribution up to $51,000 depending on your situation and your income, but that is very general in nature, and it does depend on – it's based on the income when you're looking at a SEP IRA.
Is it possible – and some people might want to throw something at the radio, but are there people out there saving too much for retirement?
That's a very interesting question. Yes, there are. There are people who we used to refer to them as depression era. And of course, you don't see too many of those anymore. But people who just have a great fear that they will run out of money. Now, what does that ordinarily look like? Well, these days, what that will look like is a very large cash balance in a checking account, a very large cash balance in a savings account and just a ridiculously huge amount of money in every type of retirement vehicle available. So the question then is, if they're not going to put the money aside for retirement, what are they going to do with it? And my comment to our clients who are in that situation where, quite frankly, they could have a 0% return on their money and they would never run out, mm-hmm. is what do they plan to do with that money? And if the answer is they plan to give it to their kids when they die, my question is, well, do you really want to wait till you're dead to do that, or would you like to consider doing something now while you're alive, like helping with education for grandchildren or do something so that you can enjoy it while you're here?
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have John on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Well, good afternoon. I've got a question for your guests today. If they would compare and contrast working with a financial advisor who receives a fee per transaction versus the advisor who's going to work for an hourly rate, what would be the advantage to either one, or what would be the situation where you'd choose one rather than the other?
Thanks for your call.
There's not a right or a wrong answer. What that fits in, the one who's you're going to pay by the hour, is generally for those people who are do-it-yourselfers or validators. What does that mean? They're just the kind of person who is going to do your own research. You're going to make your own decisions. You're going to implement your own things. You just want somebody else to take a look at it, an expert to take a look. And in that case, paying someone by the hour to give you that second opinion makes perfect sense. On the other hand, if you're a collaborator or a delegator, i.e. someone who wants to discuss things with an advisor, make the decisions, but then wants somebody else to do all the hard work to implement, or you're the kind of person that just wants to tell people, this is what I want, make it happen. In that case, you're going to need to have someone who is paid on an ongoing basis. Now, whether that ongoing comes in the form of a commission or a fee depends on what we're talking about and what the circumstances are, and I can't really address that without more detail. But those are the two differences in how the financial advisor is compensated actually has more to do with you and what you're looking for than it has to do with them.
What do we need to have with us if we are meeting with a financial planner for the first time?
Well, when you go in the first time, a good financial planner who is going to be putting together a comprehensive plan is going to want to see 2 or 3 years' tax returns, is going to want copies of all investment account statements and copies of all of your legal documents, wills, trusts, powers of attorney, those sorts of things. Also, a copy of a pay stub and any other any information about any other assets or liabilities that you might have. So a mortgage statement, car loan information, credit card statements, all that. And what that advisor is going to do is go through all of that information and organize it. That's probably one of the most valuable services that an advisor provides that people don't really think about.
Just a clear view of what you have and where you're going.
Correct. Just organizing everything in one place, and then from there can pull it together and make recommendations so that you can make smart decisions.
Thomas E. Murphy and Crystal Billing are both certified financial planners on the board of directors of the Financial Planning Association of Dallas-Fort Worth. They joined us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Crystal and Tom, it's been great to have you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.